Welcome to Should Have Listened to My Mother. My name is Jackie Tantillo. Is it your mom's voice that you hear in your head and your heart when you have to make a decision or have a moral dilemma? Is your mother responsible for who you are today? Today's guest has many interests, including art conservation, photography, music, travel, and more. Hello, Gail Mitchell, and welcome to Should Have Listened to My Mother.
Hi.
How are you? It's so nice to have you on board.
Well, I'm glad to be a part of it.
So I usually get things rolling by asking the question, are you who you are today because of or in spite of your mother?
Well, I would say a little bit of both.
Good answer.
I don't know how to parse that. I think it's definitely both.
Okay. And what is your mom's name?
Ellen Mitchell.
Okay, now she, your mom, is a former news correspondent, correct, for Long Island?
Yes, she was the, I guess you'd call her the chief correspondent for CBS Radio for about 20 years, a little less than 20 years, and she covered all of Long Island, yeah. So she was busy traveling around every day covering stories.
I bet she was. Now, and also you had mentioned to me when we spoke the first time that she's quite the Martha Stewart before Martha Stewart was Martha Stewart. She's very handy and creative, your mom, correct?
Yes, yes. She had gone to art school, but I actually wasn't very aware of that, I guess, growing up. I mean, I knew that she was creative and did these little projects and things, but I didn't know that that was something, it just wasn't in my mind. But I do remember not even realizing it until maybe when I'd have a friend over and they'd say, like, why do you have a toothbrush holder that's made at what? Like, what is that? It's like a shoe or a foot, or and I didn't even really think about it. But she, you know, she had this, like, she would pick things up, and for in that case, she had had my dad drill holes in the wooden form, like one of those old wooden shoe forms,
sure.
And then she put it on a lamp arm, and that was in our bathroom, and that's where we put our toothbrushes. But you know, like, I didn't think that that was an odd thing until somebody would point out, like, how come you have this? Or and then it would all fall, you know, it would all point back to my mom, because she'd love to go to, like, she called them fire sales, which I think were just basically yard sales, and she'd pick things up and always be having some kind of project going on, like refinishing it or refurbishing it, or we would often redo the walls, not often, but every so often we redid the walls in like fabric wallpaper, which were basically sheets or fabric that she found that she liked, and we'd staple gun them to the wall and then put molding up. And, I mean, it looked like wallpaper for all intents and purposes. But again, it was one of those things I didn't think was odd, because it's just, it's your family. And so you think, okay, that's what everybody does.
Were you typically the one that she would rope into these projects with her?
Yeah, probably. I'm trying to think. No, I mean, I think we all of us kids, there were three of us, but I was the youngest. My brother and sister are 6 and 8 years older than I am. So they kind of, by the time I was doing projects, they were almost more or less out of the house. You know, I would do little projects, but I remember being, you know, a young, teenager and what have you, and doing things with her and that sort of stuff like that.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
So where did she go to school?
She went to both Syracuse and to Moore College of Art, and she switched partially because she got married midway through college and followed my dad, who was in medical school. So she went to both Syracuse and Moore.
And did she grow up in the Long Island area?
She grew up in Freeport.
Oh, right near the water.
Long Island, yeah.
Right near the water. That's great. Mm-hmm. So then that's interesting, because as an artist, but then she became a news correspondent. So it kind of seems like two different sides of the brain, or not really. She just was telling a creative story.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. I mean, she, like I said, growing up, I didn't know. I mean, we had creative projects and we did fun stuff, and she always encouraged me when I was making things, because she, I think, realized from an early age that I could draw, or I could see things, or I would notice things that my brother and sister did not. So she was very supportive of that. Mm-hmm. But after I was born, as the story that I've been told from her, that she had gone to, we grew up in suburbia on Long Island in Melville, and she went to some like group, like neighborhood poker game or card game, and the women were chatting about, they'd stopped the card game to chat about how to clean the chandeliers for like an hour or so. And she said she had to politely excuse herself so that she could leave, because she thought, I can't do this. I think
enough
it was
comedy
to that. And at some point, I think she said, I was just driving home with takeout food and it had spilled all over you, meaning me, and I was like an infant in the car seat type of thing. And I think those two things were what I heard growing up, were her moments of I have to do something else, because she had been a stay-at-home mom for both my brother and my sister, and then I came along, and she volunteered at a local radio station called WGSM, and I think she was just copying papers and doing things like that initially, and I think that she always had an interest in writing, and maybe she had done some of that in school, but she never pursued it in any way. And so when the opportunity came, I think just one day they didn't have a reporter who showed, a reporter did not show up, and she then went out and did a story, and then the rest is kind of history, because she went from GSM to, I believe, WNEW, and then to CBS. So,
Wonderful stations still in existence today. The WGSM I do not recognize, but obviously WNEW and CBS. And in the early 90s, she had a couple of big stories. Did she befriend Amy Fisher, the Mary Jo Buttafuoco and Joy Buttafuoco mess on Long Island? Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, she... I don't know that she befriended Amy. I know that Joey Buttafuoco, I believe, had sort of picked her out of the press corps and kind of made her the, I don't know if they had a name for it, but my mom used to describe how when there was a big story and there was somebody who was the main part of the story, they would have one reporter who was sort of the liaison, you know, and that reporter would gather, it would interview them and gather tape and kind of share and disseminate, because it was pre-computer anything, so it was all via phone or face-to-face, and she spent a lot of time with Joey Buttafuoco, and she went to all the trials, you know, and she covered that whole story.
For listeners who aren't familiar with Amy Fisher and Mary Jo and Joey, it was Amy Fisher was a teen, she was in high school, and she was having an affair with Joey Buttafuoco. And Amy Fisher thought that Joey really, really loved her. And Amy Fisher showed up there at their house one day and shot Mary Jo in the head. But she lived.
Yeah.
Amy went to jail. This happened in 92 or something. So this was like crazy stuff on Long Island.
Oh, I think Amy definitely is out. She's been out for a while. And she, I believe, even went on to become a reporter herself for a little bit. I don't know whether she's still doing it for like the local Long Island newspaper for a little bit of time. I think she got married and has kids. I don't recall offhand, but I remember seeing her name and asking my mom, and my mom said, yeah, she's been doing she was doing some kind of like local newspaper thing. Maybe she was inspired by all of the press.
Maybe. I mean, what do you know as a high school kid, right? A high school teenager, you think this guy loves you. And then, and there's an interesting connection, in 93, your mom covered the Colin Ferguson story, shooter on the Long Island Railroad.
Yes.
What do you remember from that era?
I remember that I was supposed to be on that train. And then I don't remember why I didn't take that train, but I also remember that my mom was, if not the first reporter, one of the very first reporters who was on the scene and reporting from the scene. And it was traumatizing a little bit, because it was very close to home. And because I don't think that there was a story prior to that that had happened kind of in the metro area in that way, you know, terrorists comes onto a train and goes crazy and shoots everybody in sight. And, seems like it's so commonplace now, which is horrible to say. But back then, it was a big shock, I think.
Colin Ferguson got on the train, and it was a Long Island Railroad, and it was at Marillon Avenue was a stop just before Marillon Avenue, and that was one stop before the town I grew up in Garden City. So it turns out, and he wound up wounded 19 and he killed 6. But it turns out that one of my friends that I went to high school with, that I grew up with, was on that train, and he was one of the young guys that jumped up and took him down.
Oh, wow.
So talk about a small world. I mean, you and I, yeah. Right? Which is startling, and I don't know to the day if it has had what kind of a lasting effect it's had on my friend, but it was traumatizing for all of us.
Well, it was a rush hour train. It seemed so banal, you know. It seemed so it was just like the regular thing, rush hour train, and nobody would expect or suspect anything like that. You know, you wouldn't think somebody's carrying a gun unless they were a cop or, you know, I don't know. It was a surprise in a way that it can't be today, unfortunately.
Right. So now, had your mom fulfilled all of her dreams once she became a reporter? Because obviously she was frustrated. Did she eventually fulfill her dreams, you think?
Gosh, that's a good question. I don't know that I've actually ever literally asked her that. I would think that I don't know that she had that as a dream, honestly, to be a journalist way back when. I know that she was, you know, valedictorian in her high school. I mean, she was a smart cookie, but I don't know that she had that as an aspiration way back when. I think that was something that kind of came about, not fully planned. I think that her, from what I can tell, being her daughter, that her family is kind of her biggest dream that she's fulfilled. You know, having a family and having grandkids, and she always wanted to move out to the North Fork of Long Island because she spent a lot of time there when she was a little kid, and so we went out there for day trips or, you know, weekends when we were kids. And so when I was out of the house, it was, gosh, maybe within a year or two that they sold the house and then moved out there.
So she's out way out on the end of the North Shore by the water.
Yeah, exactly.
Right before we started the show, I had asked, you know, because your mom, Ellen Mitchell, is still alive and still with us in this world. And, you know, had you discussed this with her? Or is it okay that you talk about your mom? Because a lot of people I've talked to, the mom has passed away. And your response was, no, I didn't.
No. I think it would just, she would be too curious to know what this is all about. I just didn't want to think about her thinking about me, talking about her.
Telling you what to say.
maybe feeling that she was somehow trying to influence what I was going to say or not. But I don't even know why I would worry about that or think about it. Maybe I'm just myself a little bit, it's an awkward thing to talk about somebody who is so close to you and wonder, you know, how they perceive the things that you say. Because I don't even know what I'll say in this interview.
So there's that. There is that, which is fine.
For example, I mean, one, this is not quite, you know, and it's in keeping with her kind of changing her career path or what, however you want to say that. But I do vividly remember being, gosh, maybe 13 or 14. And I remember her sitting me down in her bedroom, in my parents' bedroom, and asking me, just, it seemed random in terms of timing, but she asked me if I was, if I ever felt like I was missing something because she wasn't there for me all the time. Like, she was not a full-time mom, as she had been for my brother and sister. And I thought, what a weird question to ask me, because how would I know anything different? I mean, and I didn't feel like I missed my mom because I saw her every day. We had breakfast together every day. We had dinner almost every night together as a family, you know, and she was so involved in my life in general that I didn't think, oh, why is she not at home all the time? You know, it wasn't even a factor for me, but I thought that was interesting that she herself must have felt guilty about not being there all the time for me.
Yeah.
When for me, that wasn't even, you know, it wasn't even a thought in my head ever.
So who cooked? If she was out all day, who mm-hmm. cooked the meals?
She did when she came home.
Supermom.
Or sometimes, she cooked, or or we'd have takeout, or my grandparents, her parents actually came and would often watch me after school, probably at least 2 days a week, two afternoons a week. So I spent a lot of time with her parents as well, who would be there when I got home from school.
Do you think that your mom feels that she's carried down the baton from her parents' generation to herself, to you, of what a good mom is or the messages we're supposed to teach our children or daughter?
I don't know. I think that she's a very different person from my grandmother. I didn't know my grandmother as a young woman. Obviously, how would I? But I don't. I get the feeling that my mom. I know that her generation, growing up. I mean, for instance, because she had gone to school, I remember saying, "Well, you know, I got a degree, but I was expected to be a teacher." So she was. For a little bit of time, and she really didn't enjoy being an art teacher because she had gotten an art degree. So she just let that be. But I think she definitely has always, there's some aspect of her that is very proper. You know, she always remembers everybody's birthday, and she's very quick to write the card for the thank you or make sure to there's a certain, I can't think of the word, but there's a certain decorum and a certain expectation. And I think that she, I don't know whether she got that from her mother or not, and then has passed, I mean, but I definitely feel like certain things like that have passed along to me, and I don't have any children of my own, so I can't say that I've continued a certain trend towards how I raise my children. But, I think she's definitely instilled certain things like that that she probably got from her mom. But her mom was such a different person to me than my mom. Even as a grandmother, I don't remember my grandmother having as strong a personality as my mom.
Did your grandmother ever work?
She did, actually. I think she worked because all of my grandparents were born in the United States, and they all grew up kind of in the Lower East Side, and I believe, I'm trying to remember how many kids were in my grandmother's family, but I do remember that she worked as a secretary, and the name is escaping me, but it was for a company that was right next to where I went to art school at Cooper Union, and there was the Carl Fisher Building. And then in the Carl Fisher Building, there was some business. My grandmother did work. She was the oldest of maybe 6 or 8 kids, I forget. And so she worked at some point, because I remember the story was that my grandfather would visit her and kind of was courting her that way.
Oh, he would go
visit her as a secretary. And I just remember some stories like that.
Here you have a working mom. She's able to get a meal on the table, or your grandparents, or you do takeout. And would you guys discuss politics at the table? Or art?
Yes.
Or journalism? Or?
Kind of a little bit of everything. I mean, my dad was a doctor. You know, he's now a retired doctor. But I think the conversations that were always the most interesting and that I remember were generally things that my mom would have covered during the day. You know, it was an unusual thing. I remember even one time coming home and my mom was on the phone reporting live on the phone, the old-time phones that had the long cords, and so she could go out on the back porch, and we were in the middle of some hurricane, and she was like reporting and talking about being in the middle of the hurricane, and I didn't realize that she was on air when I came home.
Did you say, Mom?
It's like funny
Mom.
Stories, like, hey, Mom, hey! And I'm like, wait, I'm on there. So stuff like that, you know. I mean, granted, that wasn't during dinner, but yeah, the crooked politician or the latest scandal or a murder or I remember my mom would call both the Suffolk and Nassau Police Department very early in the morning. She was always an early riser, but that was how you get the stories. You know, you'd call them and find out what happened overnight, or she had certain connections, and so if something happened in the middle of the night, they would also call her. And I remember one evening, I don't remember how late it was, but it was definitely like a middle-of-the-night thing. They had discovered a body and of somebody who they had been looking for who had been murdered, and I said, can I come? Because I thought, like, it's exciting. You know, I get to go. And I think she wanted the company, and she also knew that I knew all of her, you know, co-workers, all the other reporters who worked at the press room, and they, you know, a number of them would be there, and so, you know, like on site.
So she didn't say, kind of, you're going to stay in the car?
No,
you're
I didn't
coming in
the car. But nor did we actually see a body. It was in a Glad bag, fortunately. So I didn't really.
But I mean, oh my God, how old are you?
Like those experiences. Oh,
like a teenager.
Yeah,
and it didn't give you nightmares?
Like 13 or 14.
No nightmares?
No. I don't know. I think I just took it all in stride. I think it wasn't a big shock because I had grown up, you know, hearing my mom cover all of these things, so they weren't a surprise. It was more interesting than it was jarring.
Well, you got to go through the thought process with her as she's working on a story and getting the details. So you would probably hear bits and pieces and the culmination, and that's pretty great, right? Like you said, it
right.
wasn't jarring.
I mean, and this particular story, and I don't, it's bad that I don't remember who the victim was, but I do remember that it was a young couple who had gotten married and it was going to be their first Christmas together, and she went missing, and you know, and the husband was like, I don't know what happened. And it was one of these stories that went nationwide, and you never really knew like what story was going to go. It would stay as a local story or what might be picked up and go broadcast elsewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you know, and would become a thing. And this is one of the stories that got broadcast nationwide. And then eventually it was the husband who led the police or the search party to where, you know, to the body.
He killed
her. So it was kind of, yeah, he had killed her. But I think that was one of those things where there were enough clues that people thought, I think maybe the stories that I think went nationwide tended to be ones that people could try and solve or feel like they could solve them somehow or solve the pieces together in terms of what happened. And that happened to be one of them. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Pretty great. pretty great. And so she's a busy mama. Did she have any mentors, your mom, that you know of?
I'm sure that she did. In terms of journalism?
Journalism or artists or politicians or spiritual advisors. Sometimes as a kid you don't recognize or realize what a parent is really doing.
Right. Yeah. No, you're too self-absorbed.
Pretty much.
I mean, I got to see a lot of other people around her, and I got to know her friends who were the press corps, because they'd all hang out in the press room, which was in the Mineola courthouse building, and I often did go there after school as well if I wasn't home with my grandparents.
You would do your homework while she's working on things, kind of, sort of?
yeah, I probably did. I definitely, yeah, I must have done my homework. I bet you I got less done in the court, in the press room than I did when I was at home when my grandfather was looking over me, wondering what, you know, like making sure I was doing my homework. I know that she quite enjoyed the company of her, of the other press corps people. You know,
there was
there was print and there was TV people and there were radio journalists and they were all together, which, you know, is now no longer a thing. So you wouldn't have that situation. So there was a lot of camaraderie. As much as there was a little bit of competition, there was certainly a lot of camaraderie. And every summer she'd have like a big press party in our backyard, so they would all come, and she'd do funny, quirky things. I mean, she's always doing creative stuff. I do remember one year she had my best friend Karen and I painstakingly go through what must have been about 100 fortune cookies and pull fortune cookies, the fortunes out of the fortune cookies with tweezers, because she had made her own fortunes and she put them into fortune cookies.
Oh, wow.
she was inspired. She was, full disclosure, she was inspired by the back of the New York Magazine, which had for a while a fortune cookie competition, like come up with a fortune cookie statement or a fortune cookie
fortune.
And so she made up all of her own fortunes and like wrote them out or typed them out and like cut them up. And then we had to push them back into the cookies, which we
broke probably more than you didn't.
Then gave out to, to the crowd.
She's good. We should hire her for if we ever have a party. My mom was like that. She always came up with fun stuff for parties.
Yeah, she would do great things like that. I mean, we'd often go on weekend road trips, or whenever we went on a road trip, she would do things like she would make up bingo cards, like custom bingo cards. Mm-hmm. My brother and sister and I, they would all be different. And probably mine was skewed towards the younger, easier to find items. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing, but they were just basically bingo cards that you had to, you know, find the red station wagon with Wisconsin plates, or you know, the blue house with white shutters, or the you know, whatever it was that she put down on the card. And then, you know, if you got five in a row, you won bingo.
What did you get if you won?
I don't know that we got anything except for winning. But, you know, we did. That was one of the things that she used to do, which was fun. Another thing that my mom would have different names for things that I didn't realize at an early age weren't the real names for those things, such as she would call the supermarket the stupid market. And I remember having a couple of arguments with my friends. Like, no, it's called the stupid market. My mom called it the stupid market. Like, I would defend her terminology, and I'd tell my mom the story, and she'd say, it is actually the supermarket. I call it the stupid market. Like, she has to own up to the fact that she had brainwashed me into thinking that certain names of things were the proper names for them. You know, like she called roast beef, or my mom would do these bizarre things. I mean, one of my favorite things that she did was that I think I was in junior high or high school, and I came home from school and she had just gone to the aforementioned stupid market. She had come back, she had grocery bags and what have you. I was helping her put stuff away. She seemed a little down or something was a little off, and I asked her, and she explained that she had gone to the stupid market, aka supermarket, and there was a new costume store next door to the market, and she bought herself one of those Groucho Marx glasses. Uh-huh. With the big nose and the eyebrows and the heavy frame, and she proceeded to wear them while she did all of her shopping. And she said, no one said anything to me. And I looked at her and I said, Mom, maybe they thought you were crazy and they didn't want to disturb you. And they thought, don't talk to the woman who has those glasses on. She might be a little crazy. Like, this is like in the middle of suburbia. So she, like, that just like points to who she was, that she thought like, oh, isn't this a really funny thing? Like, everybody else will think it's a funny thing. But I think everybody else probably thought, that's a really strange, weird thing, like, don't disturb the person. But yeah, but she was definitely sad. I mean, that was just something.
Oh, I love
kind
it.
Of epitomized, like, her personality, and epitomizes her personality. And she still has those Groucho Marx glasses. They might not be exactly the same ones, but she keeps a pair, you know, on hand.
Oh, that is brilliant, a sense of humor. And she has her own momisms. Who set the tone in your family, in your home?
Who set the tone? Both my parents did, actually, I would say, and the dynamic between them. And I think that when they had, I only literally remember maybe three times, like three arguments. Because I think they kept any real disagreements that they had private. So they didn't, I mean, I remember kind of having a great childhood, and we were the family on the block that all the kids would come to play kickball or go swimming or, you know, mm-hmm. and yeah, I think that we were a little bit like the Brady Bunch family on the block.
Very and, lucky.
Yeah, it was, yeah, and I felt lucky too. You know, as I got older, and as I was in high school, and I had friends who were not as lucky. I think I was more appreciative and aware, and more mature, obviously, but definitely realized that despite the fact that maybe sometimes I felt a little penned in occasionally towards the end of my high school years, you know, I felt a little bit like, gosh, my mom knows how to lay on the guilt trip. I mean, you know, you become aware of things that you weren't aware of at a certain other point. But yeah, you know, I had a pretty great childhood. Both of my parents were equally involved with us kids, and you know, brought different things to that the family dynamic.
So let's talk about this amazing art school that you went to. Cooper Union in New York, and you got an art degree, fine art, because you have an
bachelor
amazing
of fine art.
Bachelor of Fine Arts. Go ahead.
Yeah, you either had, I mean, Cooper Union has art school and architecture school and an engineering school, so you don't, there's no like liberal arts program. You either graduate with art degree, architecture degree, or an engineering degree. So, yeah.
And now you are doing art conservation work?
Painting conservation, specifically,
painting conservation. Can you tell us what that is and similarities or differences between, like, art restoration? Is that the closest thing that we could put it up against?
I think that what I do is what people think of as restoration. But in North America, because I think in Canada and the United States, they call it conservation. And they used to call it restoration. I mean, about maybe it's been 20 or so years ago, before I even started doing this, the term had changed. And simply my understanding is because kind of the ethics of it have changed, where you can never bring something back to the way it was originally. So you can't, hence you can't restore it, but you can conserve it. So the mindset and thinking of it is that you fix and stabilize whatever the problem is, and then you make whatever materials that you're using as incompatible with the original as possible so that you can remove them and reverse them if need be. I know that sounds counterintuitive.
So for people who aren't familiar with either term, you do contemporary art, am I correct?
Yes, we do. In the studio I work, we do modern and contemporary artworks primarily. I mean, sometimes we'll get pieces that are a little bit older, but yes, we mostly work on the modern contemporary
and
art.
Someone calls you up or comes in and said, I have this beautiful painting, but it's damaged. Can you fix it for me? Is that how it works or something? Or someone stole it and they damaged it, but I got it back. Can you fix it? Is that what conservation is?
I think there are fewer of the someone stole it stories, but yes, but I mean, there, and it comes from any number of different it comes to us via any number of different ways, but it could be a gallery or a dealer or a collector or an owner, and something happens. I mean, art travels around a lot these days, so something could be created incorrectly, or the, you know, again, like packing materials might stick to the surface of something. Something might fall off a wall, or a crate might fall through it, or, you know, these big modern and contemporary art pieces are often hung in places that are public or places where, you know, if they're in a nice big fancy home, but they have little kids, and you might have a crayon go along the bottom of something, or a bike fall into something, or, you know, like, I mean, you think about a lot of these pieces are as large as the wall sometimes.
Sure.
And also things need to be, you know, especially in New York, they can't always fit in the elevator. So a lot of times things have to be taken off of their wooden stretchers or supports and rolled and brought up that way into the apartment and then unrolled and restretched. And you know, all different, you know, so many different scenarios that, yeah, I think if you're not in the world or of that world, you just can't even begin to fathom the number of, the number of pieces of art that move around the city every day, let alone, you know, the, how many people have art in their home.
You said it's a whole different world. Every minute art is moving, and every minute art is moving in the city. And other places as well. But so do you use like digital X-ray or climate controlled rooms or like infrared viewing? Do you use special equipment, or are you just
not
your eyes and a brush or something?
More of the eyes and a brush than anything else. But the women who I work for have a large studio, but they we don't have our own infrared, for instance, or we don't have other types of equipment that a museum conservation lab would have. But we do occasionally have a scientist who comes and can do certain types of analysis of certain pigments, say, for instance, or all those things can happen, but generally speaking, it's us, our eyes. We have a couple of binocular microscopes that we use. A lot of it is... an interesting combination of chemistry and art ability. you're basically taking something, and once you've determined what materials you're going to use, you have to then replicate not just, say, you know, if there's a paint loss, you have to replicate not just the color, but the texture and the sheen, which are just as important, if not even more important, than matching, say, the color of a paint.
Have you ever had to travel with art? I've heard a story, a mutual friend of ours mentioned something about in an airplane with a painting handcuffed to your wrist.
That's a tall tale. I have never
with zebras. Weren't there zebras or camels on the plane with you?
There was a zebra situation, but no handcuffs ever. I don't know that happens. I think that's a movie storyline more than anything. I personally have not heard of the handcuffs. But yes, I have traveled with art on occasion, and sometimes in a cargo plane because they're too big to fit in regular planes.
And you can't leave its side? You can't leave the artwork? You can't be too far away, or there's nowhere else in a cargo plane to sit but in the cargo?
No. No, you're not seated next in the cargo. No, that's not quite how it works in the cargo. But yes, that's funny.
It's not like a James Bond movie.
The cargo plane, when you travel with an artwork, which a lot of registrars and other people who are associated with museums, etc., you know, there are people who travel with art, and maybe it's a cargo plane, maybe it's a passenger cargo combo plane, and there's different things that happen, but basically, yes, you're babysitting that artwork, and you're making sure that you are accounting for what happens to it. You know, you don't want it to be mishandled. You don't want it to be handled in a way that jeopardizes it in any way. So, that said, when you go into a cargo plane situation, you watch it get what's called palletized. So you watch it get put onto a pallet, which is the, those are like the metal footings that then are fed onto the plane and kind of latched down. There's certain mechanisms that they use. And one time, I was in a cargo plane. Oftentimes, there's no one else flying in the cargo plane except for the pilot and the co-pilot. But this particular time, there were three people who happened to be traveling with a group of zebras headed for Shanghai. So I was just, the trip that I was on was one leg of their trip. which started apparently in Ohio, was ending in Shanghai. And they told me this whole tale of how they do this with these different animals. And in Shanghai, there was a zoo that needed a certain number of zebras. And so the zebras were not, to my surprise, asleep. They were maybe slightly sedated, but they were all awake.
And were they standing?
You couldn't see them, but they were standing. They were in crates that were kind of had this blackout cloth.
Yeah.
You could hear them, but you couldn't see them. And that was so that they wouldn't get spooked. But they would have to go down during the flight and feed them and make sure they have water and check on them. They check the temperature, et cetera, the crates. And they told me all of this, and I was asking them all these questions. And then they said, "And what are you traveling with?" And I said, a painting. And they looked at me kind of sideways, like, "Why do you need to travel with a painting?" Like, they just had no concept of, like, well, the painting's not alive. And, I mean, I think most people who travel in cargo, with, you know, like, cargo in a cargo plane, are usually traveling with, like, a racehorse or a special creature, you know, like, hence, you know, a dozen zebras or what have you. So, yeah. And the great part I think it's interesting to travel in different ways, and that's part of one of the things that does inspire me is traveling. And I find all the different aspects of the travel interesting, and usually the pilot and co-pilot are very nice, and I've been lucky and gotten to sit behind them for takeoff or landing.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, you realize, like, oh, this is why people fly. You'd have a very different perspective when you can see the entire horizon line.
That's pretty fun.
It's a pretty neat thing, yeah. And you can go down and visit your cargo. I have done that.
You like, pet your painting.
But you're in a separate space. You're in a little bubble at the top. You're not in the main body of the cargo, although you can walk down to check on your cargo during the flight.
Wow.
Depending on, you know, so...
That's a whole nother world. That is so cool. I have one last question for you, Gail Mitchell, because this has been so much fun talking and chatting. What gift or gifts did your mom give you?
Oh, gosh. I would say that it's not fair to say that only my mom gave it to me, but I think she provided a strong example, you know, of somebody who's generous and very reliable and strong sense of commitment. And she, I think she expects that from others as well. You know, I think she gives that out there, but then kind of like expects that back. Definitely took from her a lot of her strengths. Both my parents realized that. By having created a very supportive upbringing, it allowed me to not think twice about going and doing something which may have put myself in danger, but I always had this kind of security blanket feeling.
You seem to have combined the artistic side from your mom and then the doctor, the studying brainy side from your dad doing this, because this is like you're studying it, you're combining things, the science of it all. It's really, what a neat mix of everything. This has been another one for the record books. I'm telling you, Gail, thank you so much. Gail Mitchell, thank you, thank you, thank you. I really enjoyed spending time with you and talking about your mom, Ellen Mitchell.
Oh, thanks. Well, it's been great.
It gets the wheels spinning. We all have different life experiences and backgrounds, And that is what I really love about doing this show. Should Have Listened to My Mother. We've got more coming up next week as well. If you'd like to subscribe or share wherever you listen to podcasts, check out my Should Have Listened to My Mother page. And I'll be back again next week. I'm Jackie Tantillo.